Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested. I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the 2015 Science Year in Review Host Edition. This week, my top 5 sciencey stories of 2015, space, DNA, cars, and more that made my 2015 spotlight. Let's begin episode 322.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Cosmos is also within us. We're made of dark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are alerts. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, we're doing a 2015 year in review, the science-ish issue. Joining me this week is Nicholas. Say hello, Nicholas.
Hey, guys. This is Nicholas. I'm a recent electrical engineering graduate.
Cool. And returning Niv Gulid. Say hello, Gulid.
Hello, freethinkers. Glad to be here.
So, each one of us picked out the top 5 science skeptic atheist stories of the year. So let's start with my own picks. I mean, it's my show. It only seems fair. One of the worst things to happen last year was the murder spree of atheist bloggers in Bangladesh. You may or may not have known, but last year, 5 atheist bloggers were hacked or stabbed to death in 2015 in Bangladesh. In fact, 2015 was the worst year, but not the only year. The true number is actually 9 people were attacked and only 1 person survived. And that started in 2013. That year had actually 3 attacks. Now, you might be wondering, what was the motivation for these attacks? Well, there's actually 3 main areas. 1, war crimes. I know, you didn't see that one coming. Well, it seems that a very bad person, Abdullah Qadar Mollah, committed war crimes during, and likely after, the Bangladesh War of Independence. A lot of people don't know, but Bangladesh actually was originally called East Pakistan and was part of Pakistan proper. A lot of political stuff went on, and in the 70s, East Pakistan won its independence from Pakistan and became Bangladesh. So, early in 2013, Mollah was sentenced to life imprisonment. This actually inspired an uprising called the Shabag Protest, which was partly led and popularized by these bloggers and others. So laws were changed, and as a result of these protests, Mullah was resentenced to death, and by December, he was actually dead. Justice served, I guess. Oh yeah, and part of the changing of the laws, Mullah's party, the Jamaat al-Ism, or he was associated with it, was also banned. Now, leaders and supporters of the man in the party then started to recast the Shabag leadership as atheists intent on destroying Islam and committing blasphemy. And basically, they were taking what was politically a movement and the fact that a lot of the leaders were largely atheists or skeptics or secularists in some form as a way to recast the argument. Another reason why these guys were attacked was apostasy. That is, they were once considered to be Muslims and they are no longer Muslims, and that is a crime in some parts of the world. Now, of course, how much this actually played into each attack, it's kind of hard to say. But the first attack was actually explicitly said, where they said that you left Islam, you are not a Muslim, you criticized the Quran, we had to do this. The third reason, of course, is blasphemy and lack of deference to the ruling faith. Now, this is where I'm going to bring you guys into here. So, I think the first part was local political, who cares about that? I'd be a little curious to know, Gulid, your thoughts as being a card-carrying Muslim on the idea of apostasy.
Well, I mean, from my experience growing up here, it shouldn't really be your concern as to whether or not someone is practicing or decides to convert to another ism or stop following a religion. It should be up to you to just focus on primarily your own faith.
That's interesting, Gulit. So another thought, and I guess I'd open up this both to both of you guys if you have thoughts about this, because this relates not only to Bangladesh, where it's actually taken a violent physical manifestation, but even here in Canada and especially the United States, there's this pushback about the idea of blasphemy and about how you shouldn't offend people. And I don't know, people who listen to the show know I have a very particular take on this, where nothing should be really held as sacred cows, provided, of course, you're not doing it to be, how should we say, hateful. right? But in our society, we get a lot of stuff where it's like, hey, you said that my faith is stupid because I believe in creationism, and that's hurtful, and I think you should be silenced or worse. In which, to which, I don't know, like, your religion doesn't trump reality, right? What do you think of the idea, one, did you believe in the idea of blasphemy at all, Gulid?
I mean, to a degree. I mean, everyone has the right to their opinion, and freedom of speech is something that we're all entitled to a degree. And, you know, if you're doing something like burning a bunch of Bibles, that's one thing. But if you're openly discussing your opinion on creationism, I don't think that you should be silenced for speaking what you feel.
I believe as long as we all keep in mind that we should care about other people's feeling while we make the comments on certain topics, that should be fine. Just keep in mind that how people might feel about what you're talking about all the time while you're making some comments, especially in public.
So, but what does that say then? Like, if I go into public and I say that teaching a child about heaven and hell is a form of child abuse. What do you think about that?
Sorry, in what like way would it be considered child abuse?
Well, you're teaching a child that if he doesn't follow these particular doctrines, he will be burning forever in hell or that sort of thing, right? And that is that in my books would be termed a form of psychological torture.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now, I mean, you may disagree with that, but if I said that and you were a person who believed in that, you may think that me being disrespectful for at least.
I mean, yeah, I could see that. It really depends. If that was just simply your opinion and you were to say that to a few friends or post it on a forum, that would be one thing. If, say, you were in a position of power and you were to say, you know, no religious person is allowed to go to this particular school or something like that, then that's where I would see a problem.
I mean, as long as you're not creating a negative effect on the children, especially at the early stage when they're trying to learn everything about the world, about the religion, just keep in mind where the negative impact of your comments might lead to the children. So I guess as an educator, we need to watch out about what we say about kids.
And I think we have a good benefit here that we do have, I think, a sort of healthy community that, unlike in Bangladesh, where if I did say something, there would at least be a discussion about it, and it wouldn't be me having to worry about walking out my front door and being worried about having hacked to death. Do you have any ideas about the idea of, I forget, it was someone I was talking to, and they had made the comment that, yeah, no, that's unacceptable here, but if the people of Bangladesh think it's okay to hack atheists, then that's up to them. What do you think of that idea of moral relativism?
Yeah, that's where I would say that is a very flawed way of thinking. It's almost saying that the people of Bangladesh are like a different species or something. Like, we're all human. There should at least be a bare minimum of how we treat each other.
I mean, how would people in Bangladesh react to this? Like, are they okay with this situation, or there's some uprising or some discussion going on over there as well?
Well, the people who have committed these acts have largely gone unaccounted for. There have been, you know, a few sort of token arrests here, but it seems to be more or less that it's sort of the idea of, you know, how we have here in Canada, well, the West, sort of that rape culture where, well, she was kind of asking for it, and that these bloggers were kind of asking for it. I mean, one of the things, and this, I got a quote from someone who was in on this, discussing this, is that these murders are actually seen as a struggle between those who are promoting political Islam to turn Bangladesh into a fundamentalist religious state and the secular political forces. That is why they have become the main target, the bloggers, that is, and that the political parties who are supposed to prevent such attacks and provide security to them seem unable to do so. The main problem is that even mainstream political parties prefer to compromise with these radical groups to remain in power. So it seems like there are other things besides ethics and morality trumping the reaction to it, at least from political parts, and that, I guess, reflects to what the people of Bangladesh think. I mean, you said, Gulid, that, you know, the person might think that Bangladeshis are somehow less than human or different species or something. And in a way of thinking, that might not be too far off the block, at least as far as the people of Bangladesh are, thinking that it's okay to hack people up for something they might have said. Do you care to defend yourself, Gulid? I may have misinterpreted what you said, so.
So basically what I was referring to is say someone who was say in the first, like on one of the Western countries, Canada, United States, were saying, well, that wouldn't be acceptable here, but if it's going on over there, then I guess it's okay. Like, I would assume that we should all condemn what's going on there and to.
So you condemn. So in a way, you're saying that there's sort of a universality to the sanctity of human life.
Yes.
But at the same time, you are saying that the people of Bangladesh seem to be, what's the word, backwards perhaps, or to more negative, defective in their thinking, because they support the idea that what you just said is a universal human right isn't.
Well, what I was saying was that the people that aren't in Bangladesh are complacent with what's going on there, because in their minds, they may view the people of Bangladesh as thinking backwards.
Nicholas, what do you think about that idea that the people, the majority of people in Bangladesh are just wrong-headed, that they're nuts to think that this is okay?
I think that every country, every cultural, every religion, they have their own value. It is hard to have a universal value that can that we can be judged up on. So I'm not too familiar with what's happening in Bangladesh. I'm not too familiar with their culture either. But I believe in certain things, as long as in certain part of the culture, as long as we have open mind, we try to understand how they think, try to understand their culture. Maybe that'll give us an explanation about why they're doing these kind of things, why they're thinking the way they are. Yeah, that's my two cents.
Well, you know, this sounds like a topic we're going to cover in the future. But for now, let's take a little break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
Ooh, the endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, a non-ethical relativist view of the world. And we're back to our 2015 Science Year in Review Host Edition show. Let's move on now to something a bit lighter, like New Horizons and Pluto. This is my number two story of the year. So for me, for everyone, up until last year, Pluto was only a couple of pixels on a photo. Now we have high-res images of the surface, and wow, it's not what we expected. Something as simple as the atmosphere. I mean, what kind of an atmosphere could something as small and as far out there as Pluto have? You know, we figured, thin little misty stuff, nothing too much. But we've been proven, actually, it's quite wrong. They have, when we look back through Pluto's atmosphere at the Sun, and we can kind of discover that there's a very complex system going on. Apparently, the weather on Pluto changes day to day, with nitrogen and perhaps methane and carbon dioxide circulating from the surface to the air and back again, kind of akin to, you know, the hydrological or water cycle we have here on Earth. I mean, it's so bizarre to think that something like nitrogen or methane can behave like water, but on a distant land. Another surprise we had that it was a lot smoother than we thought. Well, smooth is probably not the right word, but there were a lot less craters than we thought. This means that the surface is likely only a couple of million years old at most. There also were mountains, ice mountains that were miles high. They even think they were cryovolcanoes. So those are volcanoes of ice. There were seas of ice with the consistency of toothpaste. And no, not water ice, but a combination of, again, methane, nitrogen, CO2, that kind of ice. We also learned that there are dramatic canyons flashing across Chiron, the partner or moon of Pluto. And that it has dark polar caps that we have no idea what the hell they may be. We also discovered that nature is a hell of a lot good at motion dynamics than we humans are, where you have Styx, Nix, Kerberos, and Hydra, again, all moons of Pluto, Charon, and they tumble and spin around in a very sort of chaotic top kind of dance, which we haven't seen anywhere else in the solar system. And another fascinating thing about this is that New Horizons was launched like in 2006, and it's traveled millions and millions and millions and millions of miles to get where it got to. I mean, it staggers the mind at the complexity of that sort of task. I mean, it makes shooting the apple off someone's head seem rather banal. So what do you guys think of New Horizons and Pluto? Gulit, what do you think about New Horizons and Pluto?
So I think any real advancement in space exploration is a positive thing. Pluto is one of those dwarf planets that we haven't really paid much attention to. So giving us insight on what the surface is like is a really good thing.
So Nicholas, what do you think about Pluto and New Horizons?
So I definitely think this is a huge technological advancement of the year, especially Pluto is such a dwarf planet, we're able to reach so far away to that planet and then take a high-resolution picture of it. And I also think that Pluto definitely brought a lot of attention this year from the media point of view, especially with the hard picture of Pluto, if you guys have seen those.
The pictures of Pluto have been, like, phenomenal.
Exactly. So it's all over media, everybody putting memes up there online, on internet, to say how much we love Pluto.
They were saying it's unexpectedly large.
Yeah, that's the thing, because like they couldn't actually get a good image of it. Again, it was only like a couple of pixels. They weren't really sure how big it was, ultimately. But with this flyby, it's like, okay, you know, I've take out the tape measure and you sort of measure it from side to side. And yeah, and it confirmed one thing, because there was some debate whether it or something like Ceres or whatever was actually the largest dwarf planet, and Pluto seems to have won out. Another interesting thing that happened this year, too, related to New Horizons, was the Dawn probe, which flew by Ceres and discovered some really nifty things about that as well. Like, what was it? There was the... actually, I love this. When they discovered there were, like, really shiny parts on the surface of Ceres, and the first thing that I heard after that discovery was that it was proof that Ceres is really the Death Star, and that chips of the camouflage, in quotes, had chunked off, and you're actually seeing the shiny metal of this alien spaceship underneath. Any thoughts on that part?
Well, you know, we thought the moon was made of cheese.
Yes, people always jump to weird conclusions. Now, there is actually a deeper question that I'm curious to know what you guys think about, because it probably affects your future more than mine. But some people complain that spending all this money, I mean, as cool as it was to see Pluto and Ceres, and don't forget the Philae lander that on a comet that was really kind of cool, that all this money could be spent on something more important, like trying to mitigate poverty or the food supply or... you know, climate change, which is a big thing. Nicholas, do you have any thoughts about, like, should we be wasting our money on space exploration or should we spend more?
I don't think this is a waste of money, especially for a project such as space exploration, because you never know what you actually come up with. Maybe you'll find out a new things about planets, about the galaxy, about our solar system that we'll never be able to find out before. And then you actually benefit us from Earth. Because of those space explorations. So I'm pretty sure NASA or whoever designed this project, whoever made this project possible, they have a clear goal in mind when they launched this project. But aside from the goal they initially designed, they initially expected to achieve, there are definitely some new benefit that will come out as the project moves along.
So I also think that there's a lot of resources we can find out in outer space. You know, we are burning through ours quite quickly, and space is almost unlimited resources, different planets. It also puts us into perspective. I mean, we're often so focused on ourselves as being the center of the universe. There's so much more out there for us to learn about. And it also promotes science education.
I think Nicholas had one good thing that came out there. And we saw this, I think, the most when it came to something like the Apollo missions, because so much of that had to do with trying to keep humans alive in space. And a lot of that humanish technology was easily transferred into we got Tang at it, right? And disposable diapers were all a result of the Apollo project. So that was kind of cool. So you never know where it's going to play out. But Gulad, you touched on something I think was kind of interesting, that the idea, you know, that there are resources out there, and there have been some mostly pie in the sky, but some talk about trying to mine the asteroid belt and that sort of thing for resources. But that would necessitate someone kind of owning them. And right now, according to space law, no nation or individual is allowed to own anything that is off the Earth's surface. What do you think about that whole aspect of that? Like, should we make space the property of everyone to use, or would that necessarily mean you could never mine or do anything to it?
That's an interesting conversation to have. Who really owns space? We haven't been able to find any life other than Earth, any intelligent life, that is. So there isn't really one owner. As for those rules, I don't disagree, but I don't necessarily agree either.
Nicholas, you're big on pipelines and extracting resources. What do you think? Do you think every part of the universe should be owned, or do you think there are some parts that should be held in trust?
I think eventually, once we start explore more in the universe, we'll be able to see some resources that we can use back on Earth. So I believe there's definitely a need for some sort of organization that can, you know, regulate all the space resource exploration, such as UN or some other international space association that can bring all the nations together back on Earth, and then we're able to gather resources from the universe as a whole species.
And on that positive note, let's take another moment and have a bit of a break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker from Vancouver, Canada, your interplanetary skeptical radio show of choice. And we're back to our 2015 Science Year in Review Host Edition show. So we're going to shift gears again. My number three choice was CRISPR. This is a new gene editing process technology. I'm not quite sure where to put it. Although it wasn't actually discovered last year, it definitely became mainstream. And the science community is beginning to realize that it's actually a game changer when it comes to anything dealing with DNA. What is CRISPR? Well, it's a way to select a specific piece of DNA, cut that section out, and then replace it with another chunk of DNA. It's really kind of cool how it works. There's one section of it that is a DNA replica of the, quote, target. It finds that target, and then it's got two proteins that cut the DNA at that point, and then it has sort of as a tail the donor DNA, in quotes, that it inserts into there. It's even weirder where it comes from. It originally was discovered as a form of an immune system that bacteria have. So it would sit there, and it has these little sort of chunks of virus DNA that it kind of knows. In the same way, our immune system has little chunks of bacteria or viruses that it knows. And if it sees anything that matches it, it goes to the virus, it just cut out that part of the DNA, thus sort of killing the virus. But it's truly revolutionized science. In fact, I was listening to a podcast recently that they were mentioning that almost every researcher that does anything in the DNA area has basically tossed all their old projects and experimental ideas, because compared to CRISPR, it'd be like trying to walk from here to the moon versus taking a rocket, and CRISPR is the rocket. Have you guys heard about CRISPR? I mean, I'm a bit of a nerd, so I tend to hear more about this stuff than other people. Have you guys heard about CRISPR? Cool.
I haven't, unfortunately, but it looks like a real breakthrough.
Nicholas?
Unfortunately, I haven't heard about either. Haven't heard about it either. Is a CRISPR an acronym, or does it stand for anything?
So yes, actually, it is. It's actually two, because the proper name is called CRISPR-Cas9, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats. That's the CRISPR part of it. The Cas9, which actually I guess isn't it. I always hear CRISPR-Cas9, but I guess properly we should be calling it Cas9, because that's CRISPR associated with protein 9. And I'll do a deeper dive on the CRISPR in a future show, but for the moment, let's leave it there. So, that being said, this leads to some interesting questions. So now, if scientists are able to target very specific parts of our DNA, life's DNA, that has a lot of implications for things like GMO or genetic diseases. I mean, before, this is just to show you how clunky the old systems used to be, is that they could implant a chunk of DNA that would create something, let's say, insulin. I don't think insulin was ever used, but let's use that for my analogy. They would sort of throw it in there, so it wasn't actually part of the actual DNA. It was just a little chunk that would code for insulin. And then they'd have to go and do all sorts of different other things to make sure that the insulin wasn't overproduced or underproduced. And that was really a pain in the ass. And that's why a lot of the miracles that we thought would come once we sequenced the human genome hasn't come about, because we had no way of really editing it. And then CRISPR comes along. And CRISPR, what it'll do is it'll take out the bad chunk of non-properly encoding DNA that was supposed to make insulin, and put in the proper one. And because it's sort of the proper or the original, the rest of the cell's mechanism, the rest of the DNA, it will do all that regulation as if it were normal, because in an odd sort of way, it is normal. But that leads to the ethical question about, and this has actually happened in China, where what about pre-treating diseases? So if you go and you, what's the word? If someone is sick and you fix them, that doesn't seem quite so bad. But if you sit there and you do something to their genome that will affect all of their children, that seems to be a bit of a more of a taboo. And that was achieved last year when, again, some researchers in China, they did an unviable embryo, but they changed the genetic makeup of the embryo. And all the science community said, hey, that's unethical. We shouldn't be doing that. Or at least we should start having the conversation on how to do that. So, Nicholas, what do you think of the whole idea of, A, genetically modifying someone's genome?
Well, I think that there definitely should be some sort of regulation before you can implement that kind of technology to human beings. I'm not sure how much research has been done. Have they done any experiments on animals or even vegetables?
There's been lots of experimentation done on animals and all that. And in fact, one of the controversies came up with regards to this was there's a particular kind of mosquito that they've kind of genetically manipulated so that it's effectively sterile and that all of its offspring will have this sort of, well, so I know you just said, Don, sterile. I guess the idea is it's like 90% of them would be sterile, but even if the ones that still could reproduce, they carry on a genetic deformity that basically means eventually the whole species will become extinct. Something that kind of be akin to sickle cell anemia, which, again, if you've got one gene, no problem. If you have two of the altered genes, then you're basically going to die. So this basically means that they can make an entire species of mosquito or whatever extinct. So they've definitely experimented it in animals, especially mice and the like. So there are some animal analogs. So does that alter your situation? Right? Aren't humans supposed to be special? We shouldn't do things to humans, even if we might do them to a cow?
Yeah, I think this technology can potentially change pretty much everything, plants, animals, human beings. But I believe this should, essentially we're comparing DNA modifying versus natural selection. So in the past, what happened to the human, to the plants, the animals, is that it's all depending on the natural selection, you know, the revolution, some people might say. But now we can actually modify our DNA ourselves, and then we can just forget about all the revolution stuff and then just do everything ourselves. So it definitely will have a huge impact, maybe some more negative impact as we move down the road. But so for now, I think that we should, you know, wait until enough research or enough discussion has been made before we do that on humans, including animals as well.
So good, I'm going to throw the question to you, but I'm going to change it a little bit.
Sure.
So as I mentioned, as I sort of stated, that if, you know, I choose to have my DNA changed, then as a self-autonomous individual, perhaps I have the right to do that. But if I do a genetic change to me that will affect all of my progeny, well, they didn't agree to this change, whatever it may be. So does that change the dynamics of this sort of a question?
Well, it definitely does, assuming that you were planning on having offspring. Or regardless of whether you do or whether you don't, it is going to change them. So if somebody modifies you, say, to cure a genetic defect?
Let me give you two examples. One, which probably will seem less controversial. But let's say that I have hereditary blindness, that there's something in my genes that just means I'm blind, all my progeny will be blind. And this CRISPR technique could be used to alter my genetic makeup so as that not only I cured, but all my progeny would be cured. And there's two different ways that works, but that's a different show. So on that case, is it right for me to make the moral decision to have this change versus for not only myself, but for people who can't give consent, my progeny?
Yes, in my opinion, yes, absolutely.
Even in the wake that there's actually a blind culture out there that think blindness is not a defect, it's just a different way of being. It's like having blonde hair.
Oh, well, I mean, I haven't been too educated on that culture. However, I would see if you as an autonomous individual made that choice, I think that for the most part, it should be allowed. And I personally don't see any problems with that.
So let's go to the alteration of that then. And you couldn't do this one, but this will try and make the hypothetical case. So let's say I altered my DNA. It doesn't affect me so much, but it means that all of my offsprings will always be male. Am I allowed to make that choice for all my progeny?
I think that's where I do know with genetic modifying, for example, I haven't heard of CRISPR this year. However, I have always heard about the controversy surrounding genetically modifying. On one hand, I could definitely see you using it to cure blindness, even if that results in your offspring not being blind, being a good thing. However, in order causing genetic modifications to have only male offspring, I would definitely see that as crossing the ethical boundary.
There's another ethical boundary that I'm curious in what your take on is the idea that, at least in the beginning, being able to modify one's genes, let's say to make you taller or smarter or whatever, is going to be at the purview of the rich because they can afford to have it.
Yes.
And not available to the poor. So won't that actually kind of create a speciesization, I think that's the word, where you may actually get two kinds of humans. You'll get the homo rich and homo poor. Nicholas, what do you think about that idea?
Well, I think that people definitely have a choice to do whatever they want to do to their body, but I believe everybody should have the same opportunity. So that kind of technology should be used, regulated heavily by the government or by some sort of organization that make sure we don't abuse that kind of technology and then make it available to everyone, since this is something different. You know, we want to make sure that we don't create that kind of a scenario where we have two different types of human groups.
Good.
I don't think that would be, and this is just my opinion, I don't think that would be too far off from what we live in now. I mean, there's already a huge disparity in wealth and resources and things like access to medical care, education. We've already created that separation between humans. So this would just be, this would just amplify those differences. And I wouldn't think it's ethical, but then again, the huge disparity between the rich and the poor isn't ethical either.
I think one of the worst and yet effective arguments in favor of letting the rich do this, even if it doesn't, even if it means there may be this idea of speciation, is that what early adopters do is bring down the cost. As more and more people use it, the cost of that actual procedure becomes cheaper, which means more people can use it, which makes it cheaper, which brings, and eventually it'll become like running water. But ethically, I don't know if I feel comfortable going down that road.
Yeah, and that process will definitely take time. And I think in that time, we'll still have to deal with that separation of humans.
So on that note about the speciation of humanity, let's take a little break.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, the skeptical show that can genetically enhance your week. And we're back to our 2015 Science Year in Review Host Edition show. My number four pick, and I'm picking Homo Naledi. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. I'm pretty sure I am. And this was a whole new species of humans that were found in South Africa, was found in a South African cave. It's quite bizarre what the anthropologists had to do in order to get to these buried bodies. It's like they had to go like 15 or 30 feet through a real narrow cave crack, and then there was this big area where it opened up, and they found like 15 or so bodies. And besides being a whole new species of Homo, it was also interesting because it was, they seems to be anyhow deliberately depositing their dead there. So basically it was like a funerary or burial chamber. And up until recently, till this discovery, we thought that whole idea of an afterlife was only relegated for Homo sapiens, ourselves, and perhaps Neanderthals. But it seems like these people were doing something akin to a ritual burial. And we also discovered, again, something that we thought only the Homo genus could do, is that we're not the first toolmakers. That there's actually a species of Australopithecan that seems to have been toolmakers. And I have to say it's assumed to be non-human because of the age of the tool, which I think is about 3.3 million years, which is prior to the rise of the whole Homo line. In fact, it leads to a bizarre thing, that it is quite likely at a certain period in our history that we had Homo sapiens, Homo forensis, Homo neanderthalus, Homo denisovan, Homo erectus, five species of humans were alive and sort of living together at the same time. And now it's just one man standing, which may tell you, well, I mean, do you think we killed them all?
Hey, Don, you said they're all different types of Homo species. Can you explain in what way they're different in terms of the genes or the looks, the way they behave, or is there anything else that are different?
Right. So everything we know more or less about all of these species is based upon the morphology of their bones, because it's very hard to get DNA, although we do have DNA from some of them. But we know mostly, so there's, you know, there are the size of the cranium, how big is the actual brain casing. Changes in the jaw structure over time have been different. Neanderthals themselves were seen to be a bit stockier, and they had different nasal passages that apparently allowed them to heat the air better than humans could, so they could live further north than a typical human could. So these are the big differences. We also do know, because some of them, you know, if you have remains of dental of teeth, that you can actually extract DNA. And we do have, I think we have the complete Neanderthal genome. I'm not sure about the Devonian or the Florensians. And I'm pretty sure we don't have any DNA from Homo erectus. But they have discovered that a certain percentage of our own DNA is shared with Neanderthals and Denisovians. So there are genetic differences, but most of this is based upon morphological changes in the skeleton. So, I mean, one, it seems, I don't know, a little X-rated, the fact that, you know, our great ancestors of the Homo sapiens were getting it on with what might be technically considered to be different animals. And the fact that, you know, like I say, throughout the evolution of the Homo species, or the hominids, the species in between that, is that there are always a lot of humanish type of species until about 500,000 years ago, or thereabouts, no, 40,000 years ago, with Neanderthals, that they all disappeared, and now there's only the one. Which, again, like with a lot of the megafauna, it's like, well, did we kill them all, or was it something else? Any thoughts about that whole idea?
I think most likely we definitely had a hand in killing them or in their extinction, because any natural disaster or anything like that would have most likely have killed us too, or climate change or anything that would have contributed to their extinction would have, in theory, I believe, would have also killed the Homo sapiens as well. So we probably definitely had a hand in their extinction, given that we had some advantages over them.
Nicholas, do you think humans are special or just lucky?
I think it's all depending on the natural selection. So, again, the making of the fittest. So whoever can fit the environment the best get to survive. And that's how it worked in the past. That's what some scientists believe. But again, I don't think humans have a direct responsibility to the extinction of the other Homo species. At least not back in the days, you know, 40,000 years ago. But with this new technology, with this new kind of a CRISPR, as you may call it, it might lead to, you know, human killing other type of humans, or humans are responsible to the extinction of the other type of humans.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I mean, we may or may not have gone out and sort of speciesly clean them. I'm trying to think of a pair of ethnically cleansing sort of thing. But just competition, you know, as Nicholas just said, you know, it's not so much really the survival of the fittest. It's the survival of who can have the most children that survive to have more children. And, you know, as I mentioned, Neanderthals are thought to be well adapted for more northern Europe. But once humans came on the scene, perhaps they could use tools a bit more effectively or adapt in other ways. That meant the Neanderthals weren't getting the woolly mammoth, but the humans were. So the Neanderthals starved to death just because they couldn't compete as successfully. And on that somewhat of a downer note, let's reflect on species past and take a bit of a break.
Thanks to sky high gas prices, we can convince America that more drilling is the answer. High gas prices? Drill more. Price is still high? Try drilling in a wildlife refuge or off a nice beach.
Our traditional energy resources are limited. Luckily, it's easy for students like you to conserve energy.
Woke up late for class? Buy some time in the morning by taking a shorter shower. Cut down by 1 minute every day and save enough to fund your daily caffeine fix for over a week. Plus, you save on electricity and water. Install a water-saving showerhead to save even more.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Listening to Radio Freethinker from Vancouver, Canada, the skeptical radio show that's the culmination of millions of years of human evolution. And we're back to our 2015 Science Year in Review host edition show. So the next one, and this mixes two things that I love really, really a lot, ethics and automation. So one of the big things that's coming to light last year, it kind of came into its own to a large degree. There are more and more jurisdictions are passing laws making this legal. In fact, Ontario, I think, is going to be passed a law or has passed a law that made it legal. And that's the whole idea of the self-driving car. Now, it in itself is phenomenal. In fact, I believe in Australia now they are testing out self-driving trucks, because they got long stretches where they go, and they, you know, even if it goes crazy, you don't have to worry too much about it. But the whole idea of taking humans out of the driving aspect and letting the car drive itself. Any thoughts with the whole phenomenon of the self-driving car? Nicholas?
Self-driving cars has been gaining a lot of popularity in the recent years, especially with the Google X project, such as, you know, driverless car. I think that it allows cars to be driving to be a little bit safer. It also allows to avoid human error while driving, and also it is able to carry people who are unable to drive, such as children or elderly people. In some recent news, I also saw some mining companies started hiring these self-driving cars, self-driving trucks, to drive from the open pit to their transportation facility, because those roads sometimes last for miles, stretch for miles, and then it cost them a lot to hire a driver and drive 12 hours a day. So that's why many mining companies start hiring these self-driving cars to reduce the human error and also to reduce the cost of hiring a driver to drive it.
So if we're all driving self-driving cars and there's an accident, who's at fault?
That's a very interesting question. Because, I mean, one, it's your car, so shouldn't you be at fault? But then, of course, you might say, well, no, it was the car that did it. It drove itself. So does the manufacturer become responsible? And that is a whole new area of jurisprudence that will be quite interesting to see how it rolls out in the future. What do you think, Gulit? Who would you blame if a car got into a car accident?
Well, I haven't looked too much into self-driving cars. I think there should definitely be a way for you to be able to intervene or sort of take over the car's controls. I know with planes, they can set it on autopilot, but as soon as they want to go back to manual, they're able to. So I think the responsibility should lie on the human driving the vehicle. And if they start to see that their car is not performing properly on the road, given the circumstances, then they should step in. And if they fail to do so, then they should be responsible.
But that leads to two interesting quandaries. One, if you have to be attentive to make sure that the car isn't doing something wrong, then, I mean, one of the benefits of a self-driving car is that while you're going to work, you could be reading a newspaper, playing a game, doing whatever, and the car is sort of doing it on its own. So if you have to sit there and be attentive the whole time, it kind of defeats a lot of the benefit you get out of a self-driving car. And then, of course, there's the second part of it is studies have shown, because, again, this is becoming a real thing, that you're actually more likely to cause an accident if you sort of jump in to an emergency situation than if you'd kind of let things roll out on their own, because you don't know what's going on and you might overreact or overturn or brake when you should have been going forward. That because you're not situationally aware, that actually taking over from the automated car may actually be more bad than good.
That's a good point as well. I think it's a tricky area on who would be to blame.
Nicholas, what do you think that whole idea about, do we make self-driving cars completely self-driving so that you sit back, there's no steering wheel, there's no nothing, or, you know, maybe an emergency one, but the idea is that you have nothing to do with it. And there's another train of thought that goes that you incrementally take the human out of the equation. So we already have things like cruise control and self-parking cars, and there are cars now that can do lane changes on their own and that sort of thing. And how, you know, you take one little step away from the humans, as opposed to a boom, you're completely out of the equation. What's your thoughts of that?
I think I'm definitely more comfortable with taking one step at a time. And also, if we were to have a complete self-driverless cars, we need to have the infrastructure to support it. For example, the roads, if we're all driving self-driving cars, the roads won't be the same as we are driving at this moment. So I believe there should be some sort of infrastructure that can support self-driving cars. For example, you know, now we're talking about vehicle-to-vehicle communication, vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. How is the vehicle going to talk to other type of vehicle? How is the vehicle going to talk to the traffic light? You know, the infrastructure have to catch up in speed in order to support that kind of environment. But at this moment, I believe we should take it one step at a time. You know, as you mentioned, we can have a cruise control, self-parking cars, you know, and then see what's going to happen in the future.
I think one of the interesting things that may come out of this, and this is really bizarre if you think about it, is there may come a point when you're not allowed to have a non-self-driving car. As in, you know, what? You drive your car? That is so unsafe. You're not allowed to go on the roads anymore, which would be kind of weird, I think. And in fact, actually, on a weird sort of way, we're returning to, quote, self-driving cars. I don't have an experience of this, and you guys obviously don't have an experience of this, but back in the olden days when they had these things called horses, they were essentially self-driving cars. I mean, you had a human who could override it, but quite often, and you read this in literature more than probably in reality, about someone going to the bar and having one too many drinks and just sort of hopping on the horse, and the horse knows where to go, so it just goes home, which I think would be funny in a way. So any last thoughts on that part of everything? Because it's the end of my list.
I think for the self-driving cars, there definitely should be some sort of regulations to be implemented in the future. And also, it brings up another question. What if there's a scenario, for example, let's say that you're driving a self-driving car, and then there are two options. The brake is broken, and then you have to crash either to the children that are crossing the street or crash to the wall. So if you crash the children crossing the street, you'll kill many children. Or if you drive to a wall, you will kill yourself. So that brings up another question. Are you allowed some piece of software, some piece of artificial intelligence to make that kind of decision? Or that decision should be made by humans? And if that kind of decision were to be made by artificial intelligence, what the outcome should be? You know, should it be put the driver's safety in the first priority versus putting the public's safety in the first priority?
Yes, the famous trolley problem, which our listeners can Google to find out what exactly it is. But yeah, like this will be one of the first technologies that, in an odd sort of way, we're going to have to program it to kill. Well, I guess drones do that now, but because it has to, it's going to have to make a death or death situation, choice situation. And how do we do that? And more importantly, going back to one of our original questions, if the car kills, be it the kids or the driver, does that mean the company that programmed that car becomes liable for it? Gulu, what do you think of that?
It's pretty tough to hold on which party to hold liable.
No, it's not. It's evil corporations. Burn them!
Because I was just thinking, like, if everyone had self-driving cars, I mean, technology can be somewhat predictable, but humans aren't. If something were to occur on the road that was caused by a human and the car was just responding the way it was programmed to, it would be tough to place the blame on the programmer or even the human in the car.
But the problem with artificial intelligence nowadays is that many software developers, they start implementing this machine learning technology where the machine will learn itself based on the algorithm the developer initially put in. So as we drive those cars, the cars will learn the habits, you learn the road condition all by themselves. So essentially, these intelligence, they're no longer artificial. They are doing learnings. They're making decisions based on what they've learned in the past. So in some way, they are the software are responsible to the decision they're making, whereas humans are slowly taking out the equation.
So it's not only a self-driving car, but it's an autonomous self-driving car, as in it's learning on its own, doing its own thing, and in a way becomes its own, quote, person?
Yeah.
What will make things very interesting? It's one of those things, I mean, when they first had things like autopilots, and a lot of planes now are essentially self-driving planes, that, you know, at a certain point, the benefit of it will outweigh our fears of it, I think. And that's pretty much, I think, the way most technologies tend to go, even if they sometimes have a rocky start. In the end, it's always that sort of cost-benefit relationship. So, Gula, did you have any final thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think that probably the self-driving car is one of the topics that really had me thinking, because it's a bit of a gray area between technology and human accountability.
So that's a very good point. And again, I'm sure we'll be talking about this again on the radio show sometime in the future, because as self-driving cars become more prevalent, the issues that arise out of it will also become more prevalent. So we're going to end my choices for the top five. Next week, we'll return with Gulid and Nicholas's choices. You thought my five were great. Wait until you hear what they've come up with. So tune in next week and find out. So that's all the time we have this week. Nicholas, say goodbye.
Goodbye. Keep thinking.